Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, and it is my pleasure to have with us today Dhruv Saxena, CEO of ShipBob. ShipBob is a technology company that streamlines shipping and order fulfillment for e-commerce businesses. Dhruv co-founded ShipBob in May 2014 with Divay Gulati out of Y Combinator. Prior to the company, he spent 2 years as a software developer at InContext Solutions, which is another Chicago startup. And prior to that, he also spent a few years as a research assistant at Purdue University. ShipBob has raised a total of $62 million from investors like Bain Capital Ventures, Hyde Park Venture Partners, Hyde Park Angels, and Y Combinator. And it provides same, next, and two-day shipping for delivery for e-commerce companies of all sizes, taking the hassle out of storing, picking, packing, and shipping products. The startup basically aims to help small to mid-sized e-commerce companies ship their products at speeds similar to Amazon. Dhruv, pleasure to have you with us today, and thank you for joining us.
Radu, it's my pleasure to be on this podcast. I look forward to our conversation.
Super. I just want to, before we start, actually, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background, because it's fascinating, right? So you started as a kind of your career, if I may use that term, as a research assistant for a few years in a university, right? And from there, you kind of found your footing. You went into the startup world, and then you co-founded ShipBob. Tell us a little bit about it. It's not a common path, right? So from research assistant into startup world, how did that happen?
Yes. So yeah, there's a lot of story behind it. So to go back even a step further, I grew up in New Delhi, India. So I came to the United States in 2007 to pursue my engineering. And fun fact over there is that my co-founder, Divay, he and his dad and my dad were family friends. So I've known Divay for 29 years and I'm 30 years old. So we've known each other for our entire lives. And so Wow. We both came to the US to do engineering. So I picked Purdue and he picked another school, University of Illinois, which is an hour and a half away from Purdue. We both did engineering, electrical and computer engineering. And then after our undergraduate, I decided to pursue my PhD. And so at Purdue, they have a direct PhD program where you basically right after undergraduate, you can, become part of the PhD program. And as part of the PhD program, I was working at Purdue as a research assistant, which you mentioned. Three years into this PhD program and working as a research assistant, I just started having this itch that if things are moving a little too slowly for my taste. And because I had a computer engineering background, I was always like trying to build things. And so as a research assistant, you are working on these long-term projects, which don't show results really quickly. And so I talked to my professor and said, look, I'm 3 years in. I've done a lot of research. Give me a couple of years to figure out this corporate world of startups. And if I realize that I'm not a good fit for the startups, I'll come back, finish my PhD and become a professor. And so my professor was kind enough to give me a leave of absence with the condition that if I want to, I can come back within 10 years and restart my degree. And so I left that PhD world and a research assistant world, came down to Chicago, joined another startup as a software engineer, and fell in love with startups. And that eventually led to ShipBob.
Wow. So you're, if I can joke a little bit, you're still within your 10 years, though I'm not sure that you will ever go back, but.
That's right. And, that's what I always tell myself. And, in startups, as you realize, things are not always a straight line. There are ups and there are downs. And when things get really down, I tell myself, okay, if this doesn't work out, I can always go back and finish my PhD.
It's actually an extremely generous timeline that your professor has given you. 10 years is generous. So it's a good kind of safety net, I guess, that to keep you going. And I'm pretty sure that you're going to make it very successful with Shibob anyways. But, you know, you have that to kind of give you that peace of mind and keep pushing. And then you should thank your professor when you make it to $1 billion companies and say, hey, it's because
of for sure. Yeah.
It's a good strategy if you think about it, to have something like that.
Oh yeah, for sure. I having a safety net, I think the broader topic though around having a safety net is so, so critical in startups because it allows people to take risks, which sometimes, you know, they might not have taken if they didn't really have a safety net. And also that leads to, you know, why it's maybe easier to start a company or start a startup when you're early in your career, because you have, you know, maybe you're single, maybe you don't have a mortgage to pay, and just, you know, you have the risk appetite to do a startup, which gets incrementally harder as you collect, you know, as you embark on other stories of your life, like marriage, children, so on and so forth.
Yes, we've actually had a very successful entrepreneur from Asia, from Singapore, and he started the last mile delivery company here. And his advice for entrepreneurs was actually much more specific to that. It was don't get married. he was taking it a level even more specific and further. But it does play a part, right? I mean, the more risks you have to take, the more commitments you have, the more children you have at home, probably it's a little bit hard to make the jump, to take the jump.
That's right.
And I'd love to also go a little bit into the story behind Shibob, because I did present the key facts and you've raised quite a significant amount of money. And it's interesting how Y Combinator seems to have some sort of magic formula, because there's so many startups that have been incubated by them and they've done a fantastic job. But I'd love to also go and tell the people and tell the audience the grunt work that you've done, right? You standing in front of postal offices and how did it actually start? I don't want to give away the punchline, right? But I know that it came out of a need that you had yourselves, right?
That's right.
And tell us a little bit of how did it come about in starting Shibob from the very beginning?
Yep. So basically after I got out of the PhD program, and while I was working at a startup in Chicago, my co-founder Deve, he was working a full-time job as well at a supply chain consulting here in a company called Deloitte. And we both were in Chicago and we were both tinkering with startup ideas on the side. And one of the startup ideas that we started working on was called Snail Mail Picks. And the idea behind it was really simple. This is like 2012, 2013. You know, Instagram had just been bought for $1 billion. Like all of the photo sharing applications were a rage. So we said, okay, we're going to do the anti-digital photo sharing, which is our customers would text the photo to us. So it would be a simple text message. We would print the photo out. We would add some filters to it. We would frame those pictures and then we would snail mail. Like we would physically mail those framed pictures to your friends and family all over a text message. So we automated everything in that entire operation except the portion around packaging and shipping. So every time we would receive orders from our customers, we would have to basically run down to the closest post office to mail those pictures out. And we realized that because we had our full-time jobs, it would be incredibly hard for us to scale snail mail picks up. So we started researching how do other e-commerce companies figure out their shipping and logistics without having to do it themselves. And we realized that there's a massive pain point that all, you know, modern e-commerce businesses face, is that they have the technology infrastructure figured out. Like they can build e-commerce stores on top of Shopify, on top of BigCommerce or Magento, but all of those back-end piece that really hasn't been built out for this modern age direct-to-consumer e-commerce companies. So at that point, we also found out about Y Combinator. YC, like if you are in the Midwest, you at that time you necessarily didn't know a whole lot about startups and about Y Combinator. So once somebody told us about YC and that this YC, once you get in, they give you, you know, $120,000 in return for some equity, and that can help you sort of quit your full-time jobs and go full, you know, into the startup world. We thought it was a great idea. So we applied to Y Combinator with this thesis that shipping and logistics for e-commerce businesses is broken, and we can be this de facto technology layer which figures out this hard piece of shipping. And so we were very, very lucky to get into YC, and that sort of began the ShipBob story. And I think what you're referring to is, you know, how did we find our first customers? And because we knew that our customers face this pain point of shipping, we realized that the best way to address that is to literally go stand outside a post office in Chicago and try to seek every single person who walks into a post office and ask them why they are there, and see if we can sort of replace them going to the post office with them basically using ShipBob. So we spent, I think, months standing outside a post office, outside several post offices, being chased down by postal police because they thought we were taking away their traffic. And I think that sort of got us our first 50, first 100 customers.
Wow, that's quite a story. And they were right, probably, that you know, you may have taken some customers away. And hopefully it was during the summertime, not the wintertime, because sitting outside it has become difficult, at least this wintertime.
Oh, man, yeah. No, that's right. So, like, you know, our early investors would ask us, like, what is your strategy to grow the business? And we would think to ourselves, well, we are standing 8 hours outside two post offices. Maybe we need to hire somebody so that they can stand outside the third and the fourth post office. And then if we run out of post offices, we just wish that the post office would be open on Saturdays and Sundays so we can stand there on the weekends as well, because that's the only thing that we knew about how to scale a business, right? And so obviously now our sales process has much evolved, but that was how it was back in the day.
Yes, it's fascinating, actually. So you've come a long way, yeah, from scaling in terms of putting more bodies in front of postal offices to where you are now. Let's look at some examples of clients, because I'd love to. And I read on your website, and there's some very interesting stories in there. Maybe let's take one or two, because I was reading the story about the Rebel Girls. I think it is the storybook, or you can pick that one, or because I like that one because it's quite a fascinating story in itself, and you help them ship to 75 countries. But let's maybe take an example and go through it, and how did ShipBob help a client like that?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll use the Rebel Girls example, which is Rebel Girls is a sort of a book which talks about female entrepreneurship. It's written by a phenomenal couple of female entrepreneurs, Francesca and Elena, and they started the company on Kickstarter. And so what their idea was that they'll celebrate the lives of extraordinary women, and they would write a two-part book about the stories of those female entrepreneurs. And so on Kickstarter, you know, I'm sure everyone knows Kickstarter, where you can raise money from crowdfund basically your project. And then so they were one of the most popular, or one of the highly funded Kickstarters on Kickstarter. And so So once they got funded, they had to figure out how to manufacture their books, get them into the U.S., and then once they are in the U.S., actually ship it out all over the U.S. and also international. And I think we find that very common across, you know, first-time entrepreneurs, is that they sort of conceptualize the idea, and then they post it on Kickstarter or on one of these crowdsourcing websites. And then once it gets funded, then they have to go through the mechanics of actually delivering the product. And a lot of Kickstarters fail because they end up on the, you know, with this funded product, but they haven't really figured out the mechanics of how they would actually deliver the physical product to the customers. And there are so many horror stories, but Francesca and Elena were like one of the smartest entrepreneurs that I've met. And so for them, they sort of found ShipBob online. And, you know, I think it's been a very productive relationship over the past 3 years, where we help them send out their first shipments out to their earliest backers. And since then, they are think on a e-commerce store, probably, you know, they're shipping hundreds of thousands of orders every single month. And so this company, which was essentially like a two entrepreneur company 3 years ago, is now like a several member, I think, in running into like maybe low hundreds employee company, and they, you know, still using Shibob. They've scaled from zero to, you know, 30 million. I don't know exactly what the revenue is, and they've used us in their journey. So it's been a very productive relationship. And I think what they would tell you about us is like, they don't have to, they, because they're entrepreneurs and designers and creators, they spend their time on things that they enjoy, which is, you know, creating books and creating products. And then they can outsource their hard work, their, you know, that back office piece of managing inventory, making sure your orders are delivered on time, making sure your customers get the best shipping experience on those products. They can rely on a company like ours to do that. And without Shibob, like if this was like 5 years ago, Rebel Girls would have to basically open up their own warehouse, hire, you know, industry experts who know supply chain management, and sort of build that entire infrastructure by themselves. And that is an incredibly hard task, especially if you're not in that field of logistics. And I think that's goes into, you know, what, why, and what Shibob is doing is sort of, we are lowering the bar on entrepreneurship, where if you have an idea and you have a great product, you should be able to compete on building a better product and not necessarily on building a better supply chain, which most, you know, which most industrial or legacy brands are built on, which is having a better supply chain. So if Shibob can sort of democratize the logistics and supply chain, where a one person company can have the access and the infrastructure which these massive brands have built for themselves, then we can help these designers and entrepreneurs create better products and, you know, and I think help them win.
It almost, it came to my mind, and there's some discussions ongoing right now in the industry about the term supply chain as a service. It's almost, I don't know if I'm wrong and if I'm oversimplifying it, but it almost sounds like you're kind of like a logistics as a service or supply chain as a service type of a platform for small and medium and, you know, potentially in the future large e-commerce players. Am I correct to say it like that, or what do you think?
Yep, I think so. But depends on how you define supply chain. So, because supply chain is such
without
a
the manufacturing,
broad,
yes, without the
yeah, without the manufacturing, right? And so, if you look at the supply chain, you know, there's manufacturing, and then there is freight. Then there is, some people also have wholesales or distribution, and then they have a different vendor for warehousing and for e-commerce versus B2B, which could be pallet shipping. And so there are different companies attacking different areas of supply chain. I think where Shibob is sort of, we are trying to be the logistics expert or the supply chain experts for direct-to-consumer e-commerce brands for the e-commerce fulfillment. And because that's the last, basically we are the last touch between you and your customer, we have unique insights into your product velocity, into where your customers are located, into how much inventory you should be holding in your fulfillment center. So all of that data allows us to make some keen product recommendations, which you can then use to sort of enhance your upstream supply chain activities.
And I'd love to also go a little bit into the pricing model, you know, basically the $1 million question of any startup or a company in general. So how do you make money? How do you charge your clients?
I think the thesis behind our business model is that we want to make it extremely simple for any entrepreneur or any business owner to know exactly how much would it cost them to ship a package from point A to point B. So based on your volume, you sort of get a pricing sheet from us, and that's all in pricing. So and basically the way the pricing works is a function of two things. One is the weight of the package, and the second thing is how far is that package traveling from a fulfillment center. So the further the package travels, the more expensive it gets, and the heavier the package, the more expensive it gets. And hence, we have like 5 different fulfillment centers across the country. So if we can tell you that, hey, your customers are located, you know, 50% on the East Coast and 50% or 30% on the South and the remainder are on the West Coast, then you can distribute your inventory across the country using our fulfillment centers so that when somebody places an order from San Francisco, it gets packaged and shipped from a San Francisco fulfillment center and not from a New York fulfillment center. And so when that package travels, you know, shorter distances, it's much cheaper for you. And so that's 90% of our, you know, of the pricing is essentially all shipping or fulfillment costs. That's what I described. And then the other charge is for storage, which is essentially think of it as the rent that you have to pay for storing your product or your inventory in a fulfillment centers. And that's a function of whether that product is being stored in a bin or on a pallet. And there's a price per bin and a price per pallet. So the more product you store at a fulfillment center, the larger the warehousing fee gets. And hence, we through our software, we are able to sort of tell you, hey, you don't need to store 20 pallets of this product because this product, you know, you have like a 1 year's worth of product already in our warehouse. So that you can sort of reduce your warehousing costs.
So that's useful to know. And quite a few of the listeners were wondering, kind of to build upon that, in terms of because right now you have 5 fulfillment centers in the US. You seem to be growing very nicely, and there's a clear demand and there's a clear request from the clients that you have for your services. What would be your international strategy, and specifically, you know, do you have one for Europe, or is there plans also to come to Asia? Obviously, we kind of touched upon it before we started. Asia is quite a different ballgame depending on the country. Some countries are made up of islands, so that is an intrinsic e-commerce last or delivery madness, really, because when you have 7,000 islands, for example, like Indonesia, 2 days delivery is unlikely to happen. So it's kind of a loaded question. Maybe let's start with what's your international expansion strategy, and then we see where we go from there.
Okay. Yeah. So I might give you a disappointing answer to that question, but in the short term for startups, are like this year we are super focused on sort of scaling US. So we have fulfillment centers, you know, in the US, Chicago, New York, LA, San Francisco, and Dallas. So right this year, we are going to focus on making sure we can cover the majority of the US population within the same day, next day timeframe from our US domestic fulfillment centers. And then I think we are starting to sort of do our research on how we think about international. And so we do currently ship international, but that is from one of our US fulfillment centers. And so for us to answer, you know, how do we think about international expansion? We basically are looking at where are our customers, like what are the, you know, the most popular international countries for the US e-commerce companies that we service today. And that will help us decide, you know, whether we need to open up a first international location in the Europe or in Australia or in Southeast Asia. Now, you know, I think just from talking to other companies who expanded internationally, I think we want to pick continent or a country which is the most similar to the United States. So, you know, massive, large population, and hopefully, you know, one large landmass. So I think Europe and Australia is probably sort of, you know, our top two areas that we would look at in the future if we wanted to do international. And I think my co-founder would remind me, more than Europe and Australia, I think Canada, even though it's right next to the United States, is actually, you know, considering international shipping. And so that might come sooner than Europe or Australia.
And it makes sense. And that's also the the challenge with whenever it is about expansion, that you need to pick the lowest hanging fruit, otherwise you spread yourself too thin.
That's right.
And kind of to move to the question that one of our listeners had, because the model is great. His perception was that nevertheless, you know, it seems like it could be duplicated. Now, of course, in life, most things can be duplicated. But basically, his question was, you know, what differentiates Shibob from the next type of a similar service, or, you know, ship and store something, or ship and store type of a platform, if somebody else, and I'm sure you have a couple of competition. I know that you have a couple of competitions.
Oh, yeah.
What would be your differentiator?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think our differentiator, I guess in this space, the hardest piece actually is to scale. In 4 years, we basically opened up 5 fulfillment centers, and we compete against a large number of, you know, mom and pop 3PLs who are single location 3PLs, or third party logistic providers as they're called in this industry. And so so the advantage for us is that because we've been able to scale so quickly, we have, you know, these 5 fulfillment centers, which allows us to cover the majority of the country in the same day, next day timeframe, versus a smaller 3PL who would be shipping from one single location. And hence, if you have all of your product in one single location, it's not only more expensive for you to ship from, let's say, New York to California, but it also takes longer. So our biggest differentiator is that one, that we've been able to use capital to scale faster than a large number of our competition, and companies which have been around for years who have not been able to find a formula to scale that quickly. And two is, I guess, another differentiator is that our use of technology to be an enabler for us to scale faster than a competition. And what I mean by that is that the software that our customers log into every day to manage their orders and manage that inventory, and the software that we're using to run our fulfillment centers, all of that is sort of written in-house by our software engineering team. So this fully integrated vertical stack that we are building allows us to move faster than a competition. And that's allowed us to onboard, you know, thousands of customers in a 3-year timeframe, as compared to our competition, which maybe picks, you know, the 100 largest customers that they can find and only works with them because it's more of a service-based solution, versus Shibob, which is more of a product-based solution where we're sort of productizing this service component of logistics. So I think your use of technology and our ability to scale faster are the two main drivers for us to differentiate against the competition. Because when you are starting an e-commerce company tomorrow, you know, you want to have access to the cheapest solution, and our ability to be the cheapest solution is literally a direct function of us being at scale.
And kind of to complete the question from a slightly different angle, but still on the same lines, I liked Maren had the angle of, what do you think are your biggest threats and disruptors that you could foresee right now in your ongoing journey ahead, in terms of the next 3 to 5 years, and in terms of the growth journey that Shibob is on? We have Amazon, right? There's an elephant in the room. you know, I don't know. I mean, obviously they're building their own. I mean, they've been building for a while now. They've started to go public with pretty clear cut. I think there was some articles that I was reading that they are building their own capacity and to run logistics by themselves and to not offer it as a service and all of that. So of course that's a threat to pretty much everybody, all 3PL industry as a whole. But I'd love to have your thoughts on it.
Yep. So I'll tackle both. So first I'll answer, you know, your question on Amazon and how we think about that. So I think we can take our customer viewpoint here, which is our customers are building, you know, massive direct-to-consumer brands. So they are trying to build a direct relationship with their customers. And so I'm not particularly sure if these direct-to-consumer brands that are being built today want Amazon to have any information about their customer, because they feel that if Amazon knew what is being bought and what that customer is buying, Amazon will basically replicate it on its own marketplace and sell it as a first party product. And you see that, you know, with Amazon Basics, where Amazon's strategy to build its own private catalog is to look at products which are doing really well on the Amazon ecosystem and sort of build it on its own and do it at scale and do it cheaper and basically disintermediate this third-party seller. And so our customers have nothing to do with Amazon. And so hence, I think that's why Shibov has been so successful, is that there is a need in the market for an alternative to Amazon, which is not interested in sort of taking away your customers. So we are very neutral, and we are in the business of, you know, logistics and not in the business of selling products ourselves. So I think that allows us to build some sort of a trust with the customers, knowing that their data and their customer information is secure with us, and we will never be competition to our customers. So that's on the Amazon piece. And then your other question
was the threats and disruption.
And then the second question is on the, you know, the threat from disruptors. And the way to think about this, you know, we are competing against these mom and pop, old school, third party logistic providers. And these 3PLs have been around for years. And the reason why they was avoided the market and allowed us to operate was these 3PLs were built in a generation where they were basically shipping to big box retailers. So they really optimized their warehouses and their fulfillment centers to basically ship pallets. The way you ship pallets, the way you store pallets requires a completely different infrastructure compared to the way you ship e-commerce products. To give you an example, pallet shipping, you know, the average weight for pallet shipping is upwards of 70 or 80 pounds. The average weight for an e-commerce transaction is less than 5 pounds. So we've built our entire infrastructure optimizing for e-commerce fulfillment, where the processes for us to pick, pack, and ship products is very different if we were operating in a world where we were trying to ship pallets, which is more what most of these 3PLs sort of built their infrastructure on. So when in the early, in, you know, in 1990s, when e-commerce came about, these existing 3PLs, they basically added an e-commerce module or e-commerce infrastructure on top. And that is sort of an add-on. They haven't fundamentally re-architected the entire infrastructure. So that provides us a massive advantage against the legacy providers in this space. So I think the challenge that we will get is not from the existing space, existing players, but from new entrants in the space. And these new entrants in the space, you know, they have an opportunity to disrupt us. But I think in logistics, the people with scale usually win. And hence the focus for us in the past 3 or 4 years is to basically build scale as quickly as possible, because scale allows us to have access to cheaper rates and a better service. And so if we are able to get to scale faster than the competition, which is basically the first mover's advantage, I think we have a strategic advantage against the new entrants or the new disruptors in this space. And us being a technology first company allows us to build software products at faster pace compared to, you know, some of the other legacy players and some of the disruptors who might come into the space.
Very, very good summary. And yes, the Amazon question is one that is on everybody's lips. And also people have seen what happened to Toys R Us. So
yeah,
that's a little bit of a red flag. And also good summary in terms of the threats that you see and how you see the industry. So thank you for that. And that leads me to the question that we got actually from a large FMCG, coming from an FMCG side, from a large producer of, from somebody working for a large producer of consumer goods. He kind of had two questions, but I think I'll ask both of them and then we see how we go. Mm-hmm. His question was, how do you delight the end customer, on top of their direct customer, the customers, and how transparent is it to the end consumer that it is an innovating shipping service that has been used?
Yep, that's a great question and something that, you know, we also debate internally. So I think our philosophy on this right now is that we are sort of The customer, the end customer, is sort of interacting with the brand and not with ShipBob. So we don't want to get in the middle of that relationship. So as an end customer, what you see on the website that you're buying from, or what you see on the checkout page, are different shipping options. And you can select between ground, same day, next day, 2 day. But you're sort of blind to the fact that there's a company called ShipBob, which will actually be delivering that package or will be packaging that item. So I think that's a purposeful decision, because we want the brands that we service to be highlighted first and foremost. And so end customer literally is unaware that ShipBob is the one who's actually on the back end doing the grunt work. And so far, you know, that's worked out really well. In fact, you know, we take that sentiment all the way down to the boxes we use. So our customers have the choice of whether to use a standard brown box, which we provide, which has no ShipBob branding, or they can also use their own custom boxes, which are branded with their e-commerce logo, with their branded colors, and has no mention of ShipBob, because that's the customer base that we are trying to service, who are building a direct relationship with the customers. And, you know, everywhere, we want the brand to be highlighted first and foremost and not ShipBob.
It kind of ties back into what you've just shared, right? With Amazon and with having or putting your clients first and making sure that they're in the spotlight versus some other potential ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm to kind of move now to the softer side of the business and building a startup, which is probably equally important, if not more important than any type of technology. I personally believe that it is more important than technology, which is the side related to soft skills, to people, to culture, to finding and attracting the right talent. You've grown tremendously. So I was reading, how many employees do you currently have? Just to make sure I have the right numbers here.
I think closer to like 450.
450. But it was a tremendous growth last year, right? So I think I read something that you grew from 60 to 400, or I mean, it's basically that quadrupled or something like that.
Yes.
So you've seen a tremendous growth. You've reached this number within a short span. And last year, it was a boom. One very interesting question that we got was, how do you, because also most of your employees are not in the workplace for that long, right? You're a startup, a lot of them are very young. How do you kind of do your onboarding? How do you train them? How do you get your, you know, graduated staff up to speed in terms of this logistics and supply chain management knowledge?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I also agree with your initial premise, which is, you know, this process of onboarding and this process and this softer side, as you may call it, is actually way more important than the harder piece of it, which is the technology piece of it. So on the question of, you know, onboarding and training, I think it's a constantly evolving process. 2 years ago, we basically, you know, we all fit in maybe one room, and anytime that I wanted to send a message, I could basically, you know, raise my hand and then speak up, and that message could easily get delivered to the entire room, and we didn't really have any need for meetings. And of course, when you scale to 400 employees, that system doesn't work, and you have to build processes and you have to be very disciplined on making sure that you keep evolving those processes as you start scaling. So on the specific process of, you know, onboarding new employees, I think we have a pretty well-defined process and, you know, very standard stuff. So I won't go into details there around, you know, onboarding, going through those initial company background, company history. There are two things which I think make our onboarding really unique and really special. One is that every single FC employee spends at least 3 to 5 days working in the fulfillment centers alongside the rest of a fulfillment center employees. So they get to pick back, ship, you know, exactly, and sort of experience the physical process just like every single FC associate does. So when they go back and join the marketing team or the sales team or the engineering team, they know firsthand what we do because they've experienced it themselves. ourselves, and they've literally packaged and shipped our customers' orders. And so that helps. Second, it also helps sort of build a sense of humility, because, you know, you might be on a salaried position, you might be working marketing, but you know that on the other side, there are fulfillment center employees who are working really, really hard to make sure that those orders get shipped out on time. And that's a very labor intensive job. So it allows us to build a culture of teamwork, that we are all on this together. And it also helps us build a sense of humility, where you know that your job is no more special than the job of a picker or a packer. So that's one. And then the second one is that every single employee, you know, me or my co-founder Deve or senior members of our team, we get a chance to speak to them right on the first week. And we talk to them about, you know, about our mission, about our purpose, and about our cultural values. I think we do a good job, I think, of differentiating between purpose and mission. And, you know, purpose, we define it, is the reason we come to work. It's the why behind why we started company. And that purpose is to help e-commerce businesses be successful online. And then we tell them the mission that we're on is to help those e-commerce businesses be successful online by giving them access to best-in-class logistics. So that's the mission we are on. And once we accomplish this mission, we can embark on another mission and then another mission after that. So it sort of builds this clarity of focus around the mission that we are on. And it does, and it helps us prevent this confusion of whether we should do A, B, or C, or D, because everyone knows that if it doesn't help us get closer to a mission, then we shouldn't do it. And even if it's the right thing to do for the purpose, we now know that that's not the mission that we are on. And so it sort of gets, you know, really quickly sort of realize that every single thing that you do must be optimized to help us achieve our mission. And if we accomplish this mission, then we can embark on another product or another service in pursuit of our purpose. So I think those two things sort of have helped us onboard a large number of people really quickly, and not only onboard them, but also retain that talent, you know, as we grow, and every company goes through those growing pains. But we've managed to retain almost all of our employee base,
which is fantastic. And I just want to ask, because you mentioned that you and your co-founder take the time and make it a point to meet everybody within a week, everybody that you onboard, which is a daunting task, given the fact that, you know, you've grown quite a lot. So it makes a lot of sense where I'm coming from as a recruiter, as an executive search angle, as a consultant or whatever you want to call it angle. It makes a lot of sense to preserve that culture and to kind of make sure that it is passed onwards. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I'm just wondering how much longer can you do it? Because, you know, in a sense of, you know, when you accelerate the growth, there might be mm-hmm. a point where you may or may not have time anymore.
Yep. No, that's certainly true. And, you know, I don't think that's true that I have personally met every single one of them, because you just can't at that scale. But I think what you can do, though, which I found to work really well, is you have to sort of trust that the team around you is a voice of you. Like, they are voicing the same mission, the same cultural values, or they're demonstrating the same mission, value, culture that you would have done. And so they are effectively your voice, and that allows us to create a homogenous sort of a culture and maintain that culture. And what I've realized, you know, early on, I would read books about startups and scaling startups, and each one of those books would talk about, like, the discipline of writing and putting down on paper what you stand for, or what your mission is, and what your purpose is. And at that time, I'm not sure if I fully comprehended it, because I thought, like, we are all in this one room, and we all, if you have a question or you don't know what our cultural values are, you just look around and you see everyone and see how they work, and that becomes the unsaid cultural values. But this discipline of writing it down, I think, allowed us to put on paper like what we stand for. So when we are hiring employees in New York or when we are hiring employees in Dallas, our people operations team can refer back to our cultural values and refer back to our mission statements or to our value statements and say, okay, this is what the founders of the company want ShipBob to represent. So then they can sort of make consistent decisions as if we were making those decisions. And that's allowed us to scale pretty quickly.
And that is something that is an intangible asset, actually, and is very hard to do. Especially, I mean, we do get to work, and I do get to work with a lot of large companies as well. And you do see everybody has things on the wall, has words on the wall. Let's call it like that. In a very pragmatic way, they have words on the wall. But for those words to come to life and for those values that are written very nicely to come to life, it has to be kind of a walk the talk type of a,
that's right,
type of a thing where everybody in the company or a lot, especially the senior management and then all the way down, should be living it. And that's much, much harder to do and much, much harder to preserve as the companies grow and so on. So it's interesting to hear how you're doing it and how you're trying to preserve it and continue where you started together with Dive and where you are today, 450 employees and growing. And I'm wondering, also, because of this growth and from a recruitment standpoint, and this is a personal curiosity as well as a business curiosity for me, have you had to, in recent times, I mean, not at the beginning, and of course you've added people, but in recent times because of the growth from, you know, you grew like last year 5 times, did you have to add any sort of executive level type of a profile to the team, like maybe reporting directly to you? And how did you kind of do that in terms of kind of making sure, because that's awfully important, right? Because one thing with startups, a lot of leaders grow within the startup itself, right? So then, right, you know, you're there from the beginning, the top 10 people that started, and then they tend to take more and more senior positions. But at certain stages of startups, you need to get from outside as well. So I'm just curious if you've had to do that so far at any point in time to bring a senior, at a more senior level, somebody from outside. And if so, how did you kind of make the decision, okay, this is the right person?
Yeah, no, I think we, of course, like you mentioned, right, there are people within this organization who've grown with this organization and now are, you know, they have some senior roles in the company. And of course, we've had to hire people from the outside as well for that senior talent. And not only hire new people, we've had to change our leadership as the company scales. What I've realized through this process is that the person who worked at stage A is maybe not necessarily the same person who would work at stage B. And you have to constantly sort of recalibrate your team around you to make sure that they are the right, that you have the right people in the right seats to help you grow the company. And that's been a learning experience for me and for Dive, and I think that's where we've relied very heavily on our board to sort of who see hundreds of companies go through this process, so to make sure that we are always leveling up. So I think a board has been really helpful in helping us establish what positions to seek and what sort of people would make the most sense or would be the most successful in those positions. But I can go into more details on that question. What was your specific, I think, what you wanted to...
Also, I guess so board is definitely helpful. Totally agree. I was also curious in terms of, you are interviewing XYZ candidates for some role reporting directly to you, impacting the future of the organization. How would you take the call? Okay, this, and of course it will be linked to the values and to the mission, but I guess I'm trying to get your process determining, and I know also you asked some really interesting questions, like the one that I was reading is, would I would stay next to this person on a 16-hour plane to India? But it's like that, you know, how do you make the fundamental distinction? Okay, it's going to be X and not Y that I'm going to take for this. And so, I don't want this to be necessarily a cheat sheet for the next candidates that apply for ShipBob, but I'm just curious.
I mentioned it was that easy that I could just check all the boxes. So, look, I don't think there are perfect answers to like that this going to be this person and not Y. I think the two things I look for, and I think you covered it. One is, you know, you have to be a culture fit at ShipBob. That is first and foremost the most important thing that we filter on. And so no matter how smart, intelligent, you know, you could fit the job description to the T, but you're just not the right culture fit, I don't think it's going to work for us. And that's allowed us to maintain this culture. And then so post the culture fit, second, you have to be able to get the job done. And I think, you know, a lot of companies that I've seen, you know, filter on the culture fit, but then they realize, okay, well, this person is a great culture fit. You know, this is the one person that we would love to hang out with and go out with. Maybe we'll figure out if they are, you know, we'll compromise our standards on getting the job done. And I think lowering the bar on that is a really dangerous move for any startup, because every single person that you're adding to the team, you know, you're sort of increasing your team size in the early days by 20%, 30% by adding one single person. And so that one single person has to be a complete A player. So I think you simply can't compromise there. And so the way you find that out is, I think just going by this philosophy of like, so you hire quickly, or once you have a reasonable sense of confidence that this person can get the job done, and you can set that up by sort of doing two things. One is case studies. We've never hired a senior person without having them do an exercise on a real life example, which they would have to do when they would have the job. So it doesn't matter if you are hiring a VP level person or a C level executive or a regular associate, you have to sort of give them a practical question that they would have to solve on the job, because that allows you to see how they would brainstorm, how they would think about that question, and what sort of how they think, I think, is what you can learn from that exercise. Second, once you've hired that person, you have to sort of set the criteria for success really early on as to what would a 30-day, 60-day, you know, process, like if this person is successful, what would 30 days into the job looks like? What would 60 days into the job looks like? If there's a massive deviation from what you thought success would look like in a 30-day time frame, or what success would look like on a 60-day time frame, you have to be able to call your mistake really early, quickly, and find that person another home in the company or elsewhere. And I think we personally have been really slow to do that, but I think that's just, you know, like most companies hire or fire slow. And so I think I've learned along the way that, you know, you have to sort of filter aggressively as well, because you should realize really early on whether that person was a right hire or a wrong hire. And if it's a wrong hire and you let them carry on, you're making a mistake, not only for that person, but also for the company. And especially in fast-moving industries like we are in, you know, months matter. So the faster you can sort of solve for your mistake, I think the better off your company is. So fire fast. And second, I think always have a case study.
Good summary. And that leads me to the question in terms of, I'd love also to ask the question in terms of hard skills, in terms of technical skills. We live in a world, and specifically in the logistics supply chain arena, technology has transformed a lot of things and is at the core of what ShipBob also does. From a technical perspective, what are the hard skills where you really struggle to find people? Where are those areas like, damn, you know, it's like, you know, I don't know, is it, let's use the buzzword, artificial intelligence, blockchain, or, you know, what's those kind of, I'm exaggerating a bit, but what's kind of the technical skills that's very difficult for you to find?
So we're based out of Chicago. So I think engineering, I think anyone, any entrepreneur that you interview will tell you, like, finding the hard engineering skills is just a challenge. It's a very tight market. And two, I think, you know, if you're doing a consumer startup, it's maybe easy to inspire people and say, well, this product is going to be used by millions of people and your friends and family will be using this product on their iPhone. I think when you're doing a B2B startup, especially in logistics, you have to inspire and motivate software engineers and salespeople and marketing that you are sort of taking this unsexy, as a lot of people would put it, and making and trying to bring it to the 21st century. And so that sales pitch of, you know, of you having to work in a traditionally antiquated industry, I think, is sometimes hard. And so people rather work in the on the next, you know, consumer company than work on a logistics company where you're dealing with, you know, truckers and last mile vendors and the entire industry. You know, so sometimes we lose out candidates to consumer companies because, you know, it's appealing to have your product be used by, like, you know, on your iPhone by your friends.
It's a fact indeed. Sure. It's slowly changing. It is still a big challenge. Moving towards the end of our discussion, I still have two questions for you, and I'd love to get your thoughts. So this one is for all the people out there. Both of them are for all the people out there aspiring to be an entrepreneur, and entrepreneurship has become a kind of a thing recently where a lot of people think it's fairly, I don't want to say easy, but it's fairly sexy. It has become sexy. I think that's the word. It has become it's almost like a badge of honor. So I always make it a point to ask entrepreneurs this question because I think it just brings it back to reality. And it's not easy. It's very difficult. So the question is, what have been your biggest struggles and challenges so far in your journey as an entrepreneur?
That's a really tough question because
millions. I think before I did a bit of research on yourself, and I think I don't know if you liked it, but there was this quote on Twitter that I think you liked, and it was done by somebody else, and it said something to the extent that Buddha said that in our lives you get 10,000 sorrows and you get 10,000 joys, and if you want to start with the 10,000 sorrows, become an entrepreneur, because you'll get rid of it quite fast.
That is probably true. And I think I'm still in that sorrow phase. So I'm really hoping after this conversation, you know, I get to that 10,000 joys phase quickly. I can't look back and say that's the one thing I most regret, but I'll just summarize it on behalf of a lot of entrepreneurs.
It's not necessarily regrets. It's more like struggles or challenges. Yeah,
struggles and challenges. So for us, you know, I think hiring is definitely one of the top ones. We are based out of Chicago. Chicago is not necessarily they're trying to make it one, but it's not necessarily the startup hub of the country.
Yeah,
it's not Silicon Valley. So working in a startup is an exception, not the norm. And so you have to really seek talent from elsewhere or even from locally in Chicago. And you have to sort of really work really hard in getting them excited about working in a startup because most people don't really have a startup experience. And so that's hard. Two, I think on that hiring phase, once you bring these really seasoned executives in, and even regular, you know, entry-level employees, I think, you know, if you work for a bigger company, you're so far removed sometimes from the ups and downs that, you know, your job has a pretty steady, regular pace. So you know coming in, this is exactly what I need to do. And if I keep doing this, I'm going to be okay. And so you are sort of several layers removed from, you know, from the executive layer or from the company's financial performance or the company's overall growth and progress. In a startup, though, because you're also tightly connected, the startups go through ups and downs and several ups and several downs maybe in the same day. And because you're all working so closely, you're directly impacted by those ups and downs. And so you have to have a lot of grit and resilience to work in a startup. And it's a hard job, not only for the founders, but for literally every single person in the company, because they're so much exposed to the internal and the external turmoil that a startup goes through, because not all the processes and not everything has been solved. So I have a lot of respect and admiration for literally all the startup employees, because they realize coming in into the day that their day is not set in stone, and they can have a great day or they can have a really bad day, you know, for no good reason, just because something outside their control happened in a startup which directly impacted them. So I give a lot of credit to our ShipBob employees, but also to other startup employees, because, you know, it's, working in a startup is hard. And like a lot of us joke, you know, working in a startup ages you. So 1 year at ShipBob is probably equivalent to 4 or 5 years at a regular company, because things happen so quickly.
I'd like to add the positive spin to that as well, for good and for bad, because indeed it ages you, but age with age comes experience. It's like with wine, right? Good wines take some time to distill or to catch the taste. So
absolutely. I think, yeah, just to make sure I don't discourage everyone from not joining startups. I think it's a incredibly exhilarating journey. I think you come in, and if you really believe in the mission, I think you'll get some real life experience of how companies get started and how companies work, that one, you will get inspired to start your own company, and then you will probably end up being a startup founder at some point in your life. Or two, you would just gain so much experience that it will make you a very, very valuable employee for the next phase of your journey. And I think startups are the best place to grow professionally and personally, build some really lifelong relationships, because you just spend so much time together.
Yeah, excellent. Much, much better energy. Thank you for the intro. Just to make sure that not everybody now runs away from startups. But
yes, please don't. Please don't. Yeah. No.
Final question from us. Looking back at the ShipBob story so far, what are the things that make you most proud of?
I think what makes me most proud is being able to assemble upwards of, you know, 400 employees working together on a simple idea that we had 4 years ago. You know, my other founders, early employees, Jifco, Anthony, George, like a lot of these early employees like have spent hours and hours working together on solving this pain point on behalf of our customers. And I think 4 years ago, I couldn't even convince three people to sort of come together, you know, or work on anything. And now we have 400 employees working together on solving this one mission. I think that's a very humbling experience that we've been able to sort of inspire so many people to come together and spend so many hours together on solving this problem on behalf of our customers. I think that's the one thing that I'm most proud about.
Well, Dhruv, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for the time, for the case studies, for the trenchy stories, for the war stories, for the success and victory stories. And I want to wish you all the best in the journey ahead at ShipBob. Keep growing, keep having fun, keep fighting.
Yes. And
I'm sure you'll keep adding a lot of value to your customers and to your clients.
Thank you so much. I had a phenomenal 1 hour with you, Radu. It's been a pleasure speaking to you as well. And thank you so much for all the great questions.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radupalamariu.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.